This is Audible.
Simon and Schuster Audio presents An Enchantment of Ravens by Margaret Rogerson, read by Julia Whalen.
One. My parlor smelled of linseed oil and spike lavender, and a dab of lead tin yellow glistened on my canvas. I had nearly perfected the color of Gadfly's silk jacket. The trick with Gadfly was persuading him to wear the same clothes for every session. Oil paint needs days to dry between layers, and he had trouble understanding I couldn't just swap his entire outfit for another he liked better. He was astonishingly vain, even by fair folk standards, which is like saying a pond is unusually wet or a bear surprisingly hairy. All in all, it was a disarming quality for a creature who could murder me without rescheduling his tea.
"I might have some silver embroidery done about the wrists," he said. "What do you think? You could add that, couldn't you?"
"Of course."
"And if I chose a different cravat?"
Inwardly, I rolled my eyes. Outwardly, my face ached with the polite smile I'd maintained for the past 2.5 hours. Rudeness was not an affordable mistake. "I could alter your cravat, as long as it's more or less the same size, but I'd need another session to finish it."
"You truly are a wonder. Much better than the previous portrait artist, that fellow we had the other day. What was his name? Sebastian Many Warts? Oh, I didn't like him. He always smelled a bit strange."
It took me a moment to realize Gadfly was referring to Silas Merriweather, a master of the craft who died over 300 years ago. "Thank you," I said. "What a thoughtful compliment."
"How engaging it is to see the craft change over time."
Barely listening, he selected one of the cakes from the tray beside the settee. He didn't eat it immediately, but rather sat staring at it, as an entomologist might, having discovered a beetle with its head on backward.
"One thinks one has seen the best humans have to offer, and suddenly there's a new method of glazing china, or these fantastic little cakes with lemon curd inside."
By now I was used to his fair folk mannerisms. I didn't look away from his left sleeve, and kept dabbing on the silk's glossy yellow shine. However, I remembered a time in which the fair folk's behavior had unsettled me. They moved differently than humans, smoothly, precisely, with a peculiar stiffness to their posture, and never put so much as a finger out of place. They could remain still for hours without blinking, or they could move with such fearsome swiftness as to be upon you before you could even gasp in surprise. I sat back, brush in hand, and took in the portrait in its entirety. It was nearly finished. There lay Gadfly's petrified likeness, as unchanging as he was. Why the fair folk so desired portraits was beyond me. I suppose it had something to do with vanity, and their insatiable thirst to surround themselves with human craft. They would never reflect on their youth, because they knew nothing else, and by the time they died, if they even did, their portraits would be long rotted away to nothing. Gadfly appeared to be a man in his middle 30s. Like every example of his kind, he was tall, slim, and beautiful. His eyes were the clear crystal blue of the sky after rain has washed away the summer heat, his complexion as pale and flawless as porcelain, and his hair the radiant silver gold of dew illuminated by a sunrise. I know it sounds ridiculous, but fair folk require such comparisons. There's simply no other way to describe them. Once, a whimsical poet died of despair after finding himself unequal to the task of capturing a fair one's beauty in simile. I think it more likely he died of arsenic poisoning. But so the story goes. You must keep in mind, of course, that all of this is only a glamour, not what they really look like underneath. Fair folk are talented dissemblers, but they can't lie outright. Their glamour always has a flaw. Gadfly's flaw was his fingers. They were far too long to be human, and sometimes appeared oddly jointed. If someone looked at his hands too long, he would lace them together, or scurry them under a napkin like a pair of spiders to put them out of sight. He was the most personable fair one I knew, far more relaxed about manners than the rest of them. But staring was never a good idea, unless, like me, you had a good reason to. Finally, Gadfly ate the cake. I didn't see him chew before he swallowed. "We're just about finished for the day," I told him. I wiped my brush on a rag, then dropped it into the jar of linseed oil beside my easel. "Would you like to take a look?"
"Need you even ask? Isabel, you know I'd never pass up the opportunity to admire your craft."
Before I knew it, Gadfly stood leaning over my shoulder. He kept a courteous space between us, but his inhuman scent enveloped me. A ferny green fragrance of spring leaves, the sweet perfume of wildflowers. Beneath that, something wild. Something that had roamed the forest for millennia and had long, spidery fingers that could crush a human's throat while its owner wore a cordial smile. My heart skipped a beat. "I am safe in this house," I reminded myself.
"I believe I do like this cravat best after all," he said. "Exquisite work, as always. Now, what am I paying you again?"
I stole a glance at his elegant profile. A strand of hair had slipped from the blue ribbon at the nape of his neck as if by accident. I wondered why he'd arranged it that way. "We agreed on an enchantment for our hens," I reminded him. "Each of them will lay 6 good eggs per week for the rest of their lives, and they must not die early for any reason."
"So practical,"
he sighed at the tragedy.
"You are the most admired crafter of this age. Imagine all the things I could give you. I could make pearls drop from your eyes in place of tears. I could lend you a smile that enslaves men's hearts, or a dress that once beheld is never forgotten. And yet you request eggs."
"I quite like eggs," I replied firmly, well aware that the enchantments he described would all turn strange and sour, even deadly, in the end. Besides, what on earth would I do with men's hearts? I couldn't make an omelet out of them.
"Oh, very well, if you insist. You'll find the enchantment in effect beginning tomorrow. With that, I'm afraid I must be off. I've the embroidery to ask after."
I stood with a creak of my chair and dropped him a curtsy as he paused at the door. He gave an elegant bow in response. Like most fair folk, he was adept at pretending he returned the courtesy by choice, not a strict compulsion that was, to him, as necessary as breathing.
"Aha," he added, straightening. "I'd nearly forgotten. We've had gossip in the spring court that the Autumn Prince is going to pay you a visit. Imagine that. I look forward to hearing whether he manages to sit through an entire session or hares off after the wild hunt as soon as he's arrived."
I wasn't able to school my expression at the news. I stood gaping at Gadfly until a puzzled smile crossed his lips and he extended his pale hand in my direction, perhaps trying to determine whether I'd died standing up. Not an unreasonable concern, as to him, humans no doubt seemed to expire at the slightest provocation.
"The Autumn..."
My voice came out rough. I closed my mouth and cleared my throat. "Are you quite certain? I was under the impression the Autumn Prince did not visit Whimsy. No one has seen him in hundreds..." Words failed me.
"I assure you, he is alive and well. Why, I saw him at a ball just yesterday. Or was it last month? In any event, he shall be here tomorrow. Do pass on my regards."
It will be an honor," I stammered, mentally cringing at my uncharacteristic loss of composure. Suddenly in need of fresh air, I crossed the room to open the door. I showed Gadfly out and stood gazing across the field of summer wheat as his figure receded up the path. A cloud passed beneath the sun, and a shadow fell across my house. The season never changed in Whimsy, but as first one leaf dropped from the tree in the lane and then another, I couldn't help but feel some transformation was afoot. Whether or not I approved of it, remained to be seen. Two. Tomorrow. Gadfly said tomorrow. You know how they are about mortal time. What if he shows up at 12:30, demanding I work in my nightgown? And my best dress has a tear. I can't get it mended by then. The blue one will have to do. While I spoke, I massaged linseed oil into my hands and set at them with a washing cloth, scrubbing my fingers raw. Usually I didn't bother cleaning the paint off myself, but usually I didn't work for Fair Folk royalty either, and I had little idea what trivial nonsense might offend him. I'm low on lead tin yellow, too, so I'll have to go into town this evening. Shit! Shit! Sorry, Emma. I lifted my skirts away from the water spreading across the floor and dove for the fallen bucket's handle. Heavens, Isabel, it'll be all right. March? My aunt lowered her spectacles and squinted. No, May, would you clean that up for your sister, please? She's having a hard day.
What does shit mean?
May asked slyly, flouncing down at my feet with a rag. It's the word for when you spill a bucket of water by accident, I said, aware she wouldn't find the truth perilously inspiring. Where's March? May gave me a gap-toothed grin.
On top of the cabinets.
March! Get off the cabinets!
She's having fun up there, Isabel,
May said, slopping water over my shoes. She won't be having fun when she's dead, I replied. With a bleat of delight, March hopped down from the cabinets, kicked a chair over, and went bounding across the room. She came toward us, and I lifted my hands to ward her off. But she was heading not for me, but for May, who stood up in time to crack heads with her, which gave me a momentary respite while they tottered about in a concussed daze. I sighed. Emma and I were trying to break the habit. My twin sisters aren't precisely human. They'd begun life as a pair of goat kids before a fair one had had too much wine and enchanted them on a lark. It was slow going, but I reminded myself that at least it was going. This time last year they hadn't been house-trained, and it worked in their favor that their transformative enchantment had rendered them more or less indestructible. I'd seen March survive eating a broken pot, poison oak, deadly nightshade, and several unfortunate salamanders without any ill effects. For all my concern, March jumping off cabinets posed more danger to the kitchen furniture. Isabel, come here a moment. My aunt's voice interrupted my thoughts. She watched me over her spectacles until I obeyed and took my hand to scrub off a smudge I hadn't noticed. You're going to do well tomorrow, she said firmly. I'm sure the Autumn Prince is the same as any other fair one, and even if he isn't, remember, you're safe inside this house. She wrapped both her hands around mine and squeezed. Remember what you earned for us. I squeezed her hands back. Perhaps at that moment I deserved being spoken to like a little girl. I tried to keep the whine out of my voice as I replied, I just don't like not knowing what to expect. That may be so, but you're more prepared for something like this than anyone else in Whimsy. We know it, and the fair folk do too. At market yesterday I heard people saying that at this rate you might be headed for the Green Well. I snatched my hand back in shock. Of course you aren't. I know you wouldn't make that choice. The point I'm trying to make is that if the fair folk see any human as indispensable, it's you, and that's worth a great deal. Tomorrow will be fine. I released a long breath and smoothed out my skirts. I suppose you're right, I said, privately unconvinced. I should go now if I want to get back before dark. March, May, don't drive Emma mad while I'm gone. I expect this kitchen to look perfect when I come home. I gave the overturned chair a significant look as I left the room.
At least we didn't shit all over the floor,
May shouted after me. When I was a little girl, a trip into town had been nothing short of an adventure. Now, I couldn't leave fast enough. My stomach wound a notch tighter every time someone passed by the window outside.
Just lead tin yellow?
Asked the boy behind the counter, neatly wrapping the chalk stick in a twist of butcher's paper. Phineas had only been working here for a few weeks, but he already possessed a shrewd understanding of my habits. On second thought, a stick of green earth and two more vermilion. Oh, and all your charcoal, please. Watching him retrieve my order, I despaired at how much work awaited me tonight. I needed to grind and mix the pigments, select my palette, and stretch my new canvas. In all likelihood, tomorrow's session would only involve completing the prince's sketch, but I couldn't stand not being prepared for every possibility. I glanced out the window while Phineas ducked out of sight. A patina of dust coated the glass, and the shop's location in a corner between two larger buildings gave it a dark, shabby, out-of-the-way air. Not even a single, simple enchantment brightened its lamps, sang out when the door opened, or kept the corners free of dust. Anyone could see that the fair folk never gave this place a second glance. They had no use for the materials used to make craft, only the finished product itself. The establishments across the street were a different story entirely. A woman's skirts vanished into firth and maesters, and I knew from that brief sighting alone that she was a fair one. No mortal could afford the lace gowns sold there. And no humans shopped at the confectionery next door, whose sign advertised marzipan flowers, sweets made from almonds imported at great cost and danger from the world beyond. Enchantments and enchantments alone were worthy payment for craft of such caliber. When Phineas straightened, his eyes shone in a way I recognized all too well. No, recognized wasn't the right word. I dreaded it. He shyly brushed a lock of hair away from his forehead as my heart sank and sank and sank. Please, I thought, not again.
Miss Isabel, would you mind taking a look at my craft? I know I'm not like you, he added in a rush, scrambling to keep his nerve. But Master Hartford's been encouraging me. It's why he took me on, and I've practiced all these years.
He held a painting to his chest, self-consciously concealing the front side as though it weren't a canvas but his very soul he feared exposing. I knew the feeling intimately, which didn't make what came next any easier.
I'd be more than happy to, I replied. At least I had a great deal of experience in faking a smile.
He handed it to me, and I turned the frame over, exposing a landscape to the shop's dim light. Relief flooded me. Thank God it wasn't a portrait. I must sound horribly arrogant saying so, but my craft was held in such high esteem that the fair folk wouldn't commission anyone else until I was dead and gone. And until they actually realized I was dead and gone, which might take several additional decades. I despaired for every new portrait artist cropping up in the wake of my fame. Perhaps Phineas stood a chance.
This is very good, I told him honestly, passing his painting back. You have an excellent grasp of color and composition. Keep practicing, but even in the meantime, I hesitated. You might be able to sell your craft.
His cheeks flushed, and he grew an inch taller right in front of me. My relief went cold. Often, the part that followed was worse. I braced myself as he asked the exact question I feared.
Do you think you could refer one of your patrons to me, miss?
My gaze wandered back to the window, where Mrs. Firth herself was arranging a new dress for Firth and Maester's shopfront display. When I was young, I had thought her a fair one for certain. She possessed flawless skin, a voice sweeter than a songbird's call, and a tumble of chestnut curls too lustrous to be natural. She had to be verging on 50, but barely looked a day over 20. Only later, when I learned to read glamours, did I realize my mistake. And as the years passed, I grew disenchanted with enchantments, which were just as much a lie. No matter how cleverly they were worded, all but the most mundane, practical spells soured with age. Those that weren't cleverly worded ruined lives. In exchange for her 22-inch waist, Mrs. Firth couldn't speak any word beginning with a vowel. Last October, the confectionery's head baker had accidentally bargained away 3 decades of his life for bluer eyes and left his wife a widow. Yet still the allure of wealth and beauty swept Whimsy along, with a vision of the green well hovering at the very end like the promise of heaven itself.
Sensing my reluctance, Phineas hastened to add, "Not anyone important, mind. That swallowtail looks like he might be the right sort of fair one. I see him in town sometimes, buying craft on the street, and they always say fair folk of the Spring Court are kindlier in their dealings."
The truth of the matter was that no fair one was kind, whatever house they came from. They only pretended to be. The thought of Swallowtail coming within 10 yards of Phineas made me taste bile. He wasn't the worst fair one I'd met by any stretch of the imagination, but he'd twist words until he convinced the poor boy to bargain away his firstborn child for fewer pimples.
"Phineas, you're probably aware my craft means I spent more time with fair folk than anyone else in Whimsy." I met his eyes across the counter. His face fell. He was doubtless thinking I was about to turn him down, but I forged onward through his unhappiness. "So believe me when I say that if you want to deal with them, you must be careful. Not being able to lie doesn't make them honest. They'll try to deceive you at every turn. If something they offer sounds too good to be true, it is. The enchantment's wording must leave no room for mischief. None." He brightened so much I feared all my efforts were in vain.
"Does that mean you're going to recommend me?"
"Maybe, but not Swallowtail. Don't trade with him until you've learned their habits." Chewing on the inside of my cheek, I glimpsed out of the corner of my eye a man emerging from Firth and Maester's. Gadfly. Of course, that was where he would have gone for his embroidery. Though I must have been nearly invisible standing inside the dark shop across the way, he looked unerringly toward me, beamed, and raised a hand in greeting. Everyone on the street, including the gaggle of young women who'd been waiting for him outside, eagerly craned their necks to find out who was important enough to merit his attention.
"He will do," I declared. I placed my coins on the counter and shouldered my satchel, avoiding the new heights of elation dawning on Phineas's face.
"Gadfly is my most esteemed patron, and he enjoys being the first to discover new craft. Your odds are best with him." I meant that in more ways than one. Phineas would be safest with Gadfly. Had I not dealt with him first at the tender age of 12, even with Emma's help, I likely wouldn't have lived to see my 17th birthday. Even then, I still couldn't shake the feeling I was doing Phineas a double-edged favor, granting him a dearest wish that was bound to either destroy or disappoint him in the end. Guilt chased me toward the door without a word of goodbye, but with my hand on the knob, I froze. A painting hung on the wall beside the entry. Faded with age, it depicted a man standing on a knoll surrounded by oddly colored trees. His face was obscured, but he held a sword that glinted brightly even in the gray light. Pale hounds swarmed up the knoll toward him, suspended in mid-leap. The hair stood up on my arms. I knew this figure. He was a popular subject of paintings done over 300 years ago when he stopped visiting Whimsy without explanation. In every remaining work, he was always standing in the distance, always battling the wild hunt. Tomorrow, he'd be sitting in my parlor. I shoved the door open, curtsied to Gadfly, and hurried through the throng of curious bystanders with my head down. Exclamations followed in my wake. Someone called my name, perhaps hoping for the same favor as Phineas. Now that Emma had said it, I saw the truth written all over everyone. They were watching, waiting for me to accept an invitation I would rather die than spend half a second considering. I could never explain to any of them that to me, the Green Wells reward wasn't heaven. It was hell. The sun hung low in the sky as I made my way home. My shoes tapped along the path through a wheat field to the rhythmic buzzing of grasshoppers, and the light's steep angle intensified the summer heat until the back of my neck grew sticky with sweat, cool every time the breeze blew my hair aside. The town's crooked, brightly painted rooftops descended out of sight behind me, concealed by rolling hills, my narrow path split like the part in a woman's hair. If I walked quickly, I could make it back in precisely 32 minutes. It was always summer in Whimsy. Here the seasons didn't change according to the passage of time as they did in the world beyond, an idea I could barely fathom. While I walked my walk that never changed, the painting's oddly colored trees haunted me like a recent dream. Autumn was to all accounts a dreary time, a withering of the world when birds vanished and the leaves discolored and fell from their branches as though dying. Surely what we had was better, safer. Endlessly blue skies and eternally golden wheat might be boring, but I told myself, not for the first time, that it was foolish to long for anything else. A person could suffer worse things than being bored, and in the world beyond, they did. A whiff of decay jogged me from my frustrated thoughts. This part of the path wove near the forest's edge, and I cast a wary glance into its shadows. Dense honeysuckles and briars flourished like a barrier beneath the branches. In days long past, during the less friendly time before iron was outlawed, farmers had risked their lives driving iron nails into the outermost trees to ward off fairy wickedness. The sight of the old bent nails, rusted and twisted almost beyond recognition, always gave me a prickle of unease. Sweeping my gaze across the undergrowth again, I saw nothing amiss. No doubt I was being paranoid about a dead squirrel rotting somewhere nearby. Reluctantly reassured, I checked my satchel for the fourth or fifth time, just to make sure I hadn't left anything behind at the store, an odd habit of mine, as I never made such mistakes. When I looked up, something was wrong. A creature stood on the rise of the next hill, beside the lone oak that marked the halfway point home. My first thought was that it was a stag, a tremendously big one, but it was the right shape, more or less. Four legs, two antlers. Then it turned to look in my direction, and right away I understood it wasn't. Just like that, the wrongness spread. The breeze dropped away, and the air grew still and oppressively hot. The birds stopped singing, the grasshoppers stopped buzzing, and even the wheat drooped in the stagnant air. The stench of decay grew overwhelming. I dropped down to my hands and knees, but it was too late. The not a stag stood watching me. Despite the heat, a fever chill shivered over my skin and crystallized in my stomach. I knew what it was, this not a stag. I also knew I was dead. No one could run or hide from a fairy beast. This creature had risen from a barrow mound, a grotesque union of fairy magic and ancient human remains. Some acted as servants and guards to their masters. Others crept from the earth unbidden. One such monster killed my mother and father when I was a little girl. So terribly, Emma hadn't let me see their bodies, and I was going to die the same way. I don't think my mind could quite process this, because my next thought was that I shouldn't have wasted money buying pigments. I was never going to use them now. The fairy beast lowered its head and bellowed across the field, a deep, rousing, and putrid sound, as though someone had blown into an ancient, once exquisite hunting horn stuffed full of rotting moss. It swung its heavy body around, antlers first, and sprang down the hill. I lunged from my crouch and ran, not toward the safety of my house half a mile in the distance, but away from it, into the field. If I was going to do anything of value in my last moments alive, I might as well try to lead the thing as far away from my family as I could manage. The wheat parted around my hiked-up skirts. Stems crunched beneath my boots, and prickly seed heads scratched welts across my bare arms as they whipped past. My satchel bounced against the backs of my thighs, cumbersome, slowing me down. Grasshoppers shot out of the way as if flicked from the field by an invisible hand. At first, I heard nothing but the rasping of my own breath. None of it felt real. I might as well have been running through a field for the fun of it, on a lovely day beneath a flawless blue sky. Then a shadow's coolness touched my sweaty back, and darkness enveloped me. The wheat thrashed like waves in a storm-tossed ocean. A hoof slammed down beside me, burying itself deep in the soil. I threw myself backward, stumbled, and fell, floundering among the shafts. The fairy beast loomed over me. A proud stag's guise rippled over it like the reflection of sun on water. In the dark spaces between the illusion lay a skeletal form of decomposing bark held together by vines that shifted like tendons, a hollowed skull-like face, antlers that were not truly antlers, but instead a pair of crooked branches wound tight with thorny briars, each one as long as a man was tall. A sickness lay over it. As it snorted and raised a quivering leg, bark sloughed away and tumbled across the ground. Shiny beetles swarmed out of the pieces, skittering over my stockings as they fled in every direction. I retched at the taste of rot coating the inside of my mouth. The fairy beast reared up, blocking out the sun. I thought my last sight on Earth was going to be the constellation of maggots weaving in and out of its belly. Therefore, I wasn't certain how to react when the monster simply collapsed in front of me into a soft, tumbling heap of worm-eaten wood. Centipedes longer than my hand spooled out into the grass. Two huge, spotted moths took wing. The grasshoppers began buzzing again right away, as though nothing had happened. But still, I lay clammy and trembling on the ground, blood pounding in my ears. With a repulsed cry, I kicked at the pile. Bone fragments scattered along with the bark. The human corpse that gave it life had been destroyed.
"I've been tracking that beast for 2 days, and I might not have caught up to it if you hadn't drawn its attention," said a warm, lively voice. "It's called a Thane, in case you're interested."
My gaze snapped up from the fairy beast's remains. A man stood before me, so eclipsed by the sun I couldn't make out his features, only that he was tall and slender and in the process of sheathing a sword. "Drawn, it's..." I stopped, baffled and more than a little offended. He spoke as if this were sport, as though my life mattered not at all, which of course told me everything I needed to know. This figure might look like a man, but he wasn't one. "Thank you," I backtracked, choking down my protests. "You've saved my life."
"Have I? From the Thane? I suppose I have. In that case, you're most welcome. Oh, I don't know your name."
A frisson of unease rattled me like a thunderclap in the dead of night. He didn't recognize me, which meant he didn't visit Whimsy often, if at all. Whoever he was bound to be more dangerous than the fair folk I normally dealt with. And like all of his species, he couldn't resist seeking my true name. I paused, evaluating my mind and senses, and came to the relieved conclusion that he hadn't put me under a malicious charm, one that might make me speak more freely or reveal secrets I ought not. Because no one used their birth name in Whimsy. To do so would be to expose oneself to ensorcelment, by which a fair one could control a mortal in body and soul forever, without their even knowing, merely through the power of that single, secret word. It was the most wicked form of fairy magic, and the most feared. "Isabel," I supplied, scrambling to my feet. I dropped him a curtsy. If he realized I'd given him my false name, he showed no sign. He stepped right over the pile in one long-legged stride, bowed deeply, and took my hand in his. He raised it and kissed it. I hid a frown. Supposing he had to touch me, I rather wished he'd helped me up instead.
"You're most welcome, Isabel," he said.
His lips were cool against my knuckles. With his head ducked before me, I only saw his hair, which was unruly, wavy, not quite curly, and dark, with just the slightest red tint in the sun. Its fierce unkemptness reminded me of a hawk's or raven's feathers blown the wrong way in a strong wind. And like Gadfly, I could smell him, the spice of crisp, dry leaves, of cool nights under a clear moon, a wildness, a longing. My heart hammered from terror of the fairy beast and the equal danger of meeting a fair one alone in a field. Therefore, I beg you to excuse my foolishness when I say that suddenly I wanted that smell more than anything I had ever wanted before. I wanted it with a terrifying thirst. Not him, exactly, but rather whatever great, mysterious change it represented, a promise that somewhere the world was different. Well, that simply wouldn't do. I hoisted my annoyance back up like a flag on a mast.
I've never known a kiss on the hand to last so long, sir.
He straightened.
Nothing seems long to a fair one,
he replied with a half-smile. By my reckoning, he looked a year or two my elder, though of course his real age might have been more than 100 times that count. He had fine, aristocratic features, at odds with his unruly hair, and an expressive mouth I instantly wanted to paint. The shadows at the corners of his lips, the faint crease on one side, where his smile became crooked.
I said, he remarked, nothing seems long to a fair one.
I looked up to find him staring at me in perplexed fascination, with the smile still frozen on his face. There was his flaw. The color of his eyes, a peculiar shade of amethyst, striking against his golden-brown complexion, which put me in mind of late-afternoon sunlight dappling fallen leaves. His eyes instantly bothered me for a reason other than their unusual hue, but try as I might, I couldn't put my finger on why.
Forgive me, I'm a portrait artist, and I have a habit of looking at people and forgetting about everything else while I'm doing it. I did hear what you said. I just don't have an answer.
The fair one's gaze flicked down to my satchel. When he returned his attention to me, his smile had faded.
Of course. I imagine our lives are beyond human comprehension for the most part.
Do you know why the Thane came out of the forest into Whimsy, sir?
I asked, because I got the sense he was waiting for some sort of validation regarding his mysteriousness, and I wanted to keep the conversation both short and practical. Fairy beasts were rarely glimpsed here, and its presence was beyond troubling.
This I cannot say. Perhaps the wild hunt flushed it out. Perhaps it merely felt like wandering. There have been more of them about lately, and they're causing an awful mess.
Lately could mean anything to a fair one. My parents' deaths included.
Yes, dead humans do tend to be messy.
His eyebrows shifted minutely, creating a furrow in the middle, and his gaze sharpened to scrutiny. He knew he'd upset me somehow, but in typical fair folk fashion, wasn't able to divine why. He was no more able to understand the sorrow of a human's death than a fox might mourn the killing of a mouse. One thing I knew for certain, I didn't want to linger long enough for him to decide that his confusion offended him and the cause of it deserved revenge in the form of a nasty enchantment. I ducked my head and curtsied again.
Whimsy's people are grateful for your protection. I'll never forget what you've done for me today. Good day, sir.
I waited until he'd bowed again before I turned back toward the path.
Wait,
he said. I froze. Behind me, the sound of wheat shifting.
I said something wrong. I apologize.
Slowly, I looked over my shoulder to find him watching me, looking oddly uncertain. I had no idea what to make of it. Fair folk were known to extend apologies on occasion. They valued good manners highly, but most of the time they followed a double standard according to which they expected humans to be the polite ones while doing everything in their power to avoid acknowledging their own misbehavior. I was flabbergasted. So I said the only thing that came to mind.
I accept your apology.
Oh, good.
His half-smile reappeared, and in an instant he went from looking uncertain to looking quite pleased with himself.
I'll see you tomorrow then, Isabel.
I'd already started walking by the time his words sank in, and I realized what they meant. I whirled around again, but the fair one, who could be none other than the Autumn Prince, was gone. Wheat swayed around the empty path, and the only sign of life in the entire field was a single raven winging away toward the forest, with a red sheen on its feathers where they caught the fading light. Three. I still had no idea when the prince might arrive, and with my aunt in town making a house call, the responsibility of emptying our kitchen of goat children fell to me. Easier said than done.
He called our names weird,
May shrieked, while March sobbed silently next to the stove. Never had I loathed the baker's boy more, though truth be told, he was quite nice, and he did have a point. I squatted down and took them both by the shoulders. Well, when Aunt Emma and I named you, I said reasonably, you were goats. You were already familiar with March and May by then, and we weren't certain whether the enchantment would last, so we decided not to make changes. March gave a strangled sob. I needed a different tactic. Listen, I have an important question. What are your favorite things?
Scaring people, said May after a moment of thought.
March opened her mouth and pointed into it. Oh, God. Those things are weird, aren't they? May eyed me warily.
Maybe.
Yes, they're definitely weird, I said in a firm voice. So weird isn't really bad, is it? It's good, like scaring people or eating salamanders. Harold was paying you a compliment. May said. She didn't look convinced, but at least March had stopped crying, so for my sanity's sake, I declared this round a partial victory. Now, come on. The two of you need to play outside until our guest leaves. Remember, don't go past the edge of the wheat field. As I pushed them toward the door, a slimy coil of unease stirred in my stomach. If another fairy beast emerged from the forest? Such events were extraordinarily rare, and I couldn't forget how easily the prince had dispatched the monster yesterday. Surely we were safe with him visiting. But the uneasiness wouldn't pass, and I added, if you hear the grasshoppers go quiet, come back to the house right away. May peered up at me with her eyebrows bunched in suspicion.
Why?
Because I said so.
Why can't we just play in the house?
I propelled them down the stoop while our rickety kitchen door banged shut behind us. I noted with relief that it looked perfectly normal outside. The chickens muttered to themselves as they stalked across the yard, the trees rippled in a lively breeze, and shadows raced over the rolling hills. Yet May kept staring at me. I realized my stomach was still clenched tight as a fist, and it must show on my face. You already know the reason, I said briskly, stomping down my guilt. Honestly, there were multiple reasons. May had knocked over my easels on more than one occasion. March exhibited an insatiable appetite for Prussian blue. But most of all, fairy folk didn't like having them around. My theory was that the twins embarrassed them, being visible proof of one of their mistakes, and unintentionally powerful proof to boot. I knew for a fact they couldn't be ensorcelled. March and May were their true names. If the fairy folk could use that knowledge against them, they would have done so by now. March gave a delighted bleat and went capering over to the woodpile, but May didn't look away.
Don't worry, we won't get hurt, she said
finally, soberly, and patted my knee. Then she tore off after her sister. My eyes stung. Busily, I straightened my skirts and shoved a few stray hairs behind my ears. I didn't want them to see I was affected, and I didn't want to admit it to myself either. When I focused on keeping everything in order, I didn't have to think about what had happened to my parents or why the event still gripped me with panic 12 years later when I hadn't even been there, seen or heard a single part of it. Yet obviously I didn't hide my fear well enough. Even May could see it. A raven's hoarse croak sounded from the tree shading the yard. Shoo, I said, hardly looking up. Ravens scared away the songbirds that nested in our bushes, and Emma and I made every effort to return the favor. My unease faded in the warm sun and the sight of March and May scrambling on top of the logs. From a distance, the only way to tell them apart was the pattern of white splotches on their otherwise pink skin. May had one that went over her left cheek and half her nose. Their curly black hair was identical, as was the gap between their front teeth and their startlingly fiendish eyebrows. They looked like a pair of cupids who had decided they liked shooting people with real arrows better. They were horrible. I loved them so much. But I couldn't forget that the prince was coming, and apprehension lapped restlessly at the dark shores of my subconscious. The raven croaked again. This time, I did look up. The raven turned its head to and fro, eyeing my frown. It ruffled its feathers and hopped smartly along the branch. When it emerged into the light, my breath caught in my throat. Its back had a red sheen, and it seemed to me its eyes were an unusual color. I lunged into a swift curtsy and then dove inside, torn between hoping the raven wasn't the prince after all, and the knowledge that if that was the case, I'd just curtsied at and promptly fled from a bird. The loose kitchen door went thud, thud, thud behind me. A fourth thud sounded, but it wasn't the door banging. It was a knock. "Come in," I called back. I looked around and wished I hadn't. At random, I seized a pot and shoved it into the wash basin. I'm not sure whether it was even dirty, but that was all I had time to do before the door swung open again and the Autumn Prince stepped inside. The doorframe was made for average-sized humans, and he had to duck to avoid hitting his head on the lintel.
"Good afternoon, Isabel,"
he said, and gave me a courtly bow. I'd never had a fair one in my kitchen before. It was a small room with rough stone walls, floorboards so worn with age they sagged in the middle, and one high window that let in a bit of light, just enough to draw special attention to the stack of unwashed dishes beside the cupboard and the sad-looking lump of peat still smoldering in our little chest-height hearth. Meanwhile, the prince looked as though he'd just stepped from a gilded carriage drawn by half a dozen white stallions. I didn't well remember what he'd been wearing the day before, but if it had looked like this, I would have. His close-fitting dark silk coat nearly brushed the ground behind his boots, cloak-like, lined with copper-colored velvet. He wore a matching copper circlet on his brow, and though his wild hair seemed to have developed a life of its own and swallowed much of the circlet, I made out that it was shaped like intertwined leaves and speckled green with verdigris. He had a raven-shaped cloak pin attached to his collar, no doubt a relic from a previous era. The sword from the day before still hung at his waist. Yes, there he was, standing mere inches from a moldy onion skin I hadn't swept up that morning. I had already violated the standards of etiquette. What I said next needed to be thoughtful and poised. I blurted out instead, "What happens if you can't bow back?" Occupying himself while I mustered myself, the prince had turned to stare intently at a ladle. Now he stared at me instead. "What are you?" his mystified amethyst eyes seemed to say.
"I don't believe I understand."
The saggy floorboards were bound to give way eventually. Maybe they'd do me a favor and make it happen now. "If someone bows or curtsies at you and you aren't able to return it right away," I heard myself explain. Understanding lit his expression, and his familiar half-smile reappeared. He leaned toward me and met my eyes as though confiding a great secret. Perhaps he was.
"It's terribly uncomfortable,"
he said quietly.
"We have to look for whoever did it until we find them, and can't think about anything else in the meantime."
"Oh. I suppose I just did that. I'm sorry." He straightened, seeming to forget about me in an instant.
"Finding you was my pleasure,"
he said warmly, though rather distantly, and picked up a meat skewer.
"Is this a weapon?"
I carefully took the skewer from him and set it back down. "Not by design, no."
"I see,"
he said, and before I could stop him, he crossed the kitchen in three great strides to inspect a skillet hanging from a nail in the wall.
"This is almost certainly a weapon."
"It isn't." This was the most tongue-tied I'd ever been in the presence of a fair one. "Well, it can be utilized as one, certainly, but it's for cooking." He looked around at me. "Craft to make food," I clarified, because his eyebrows were drawn together in polite consternation, verging on alarm.
"Yes, I know what cooking is," he said. "I was merely astonished that so many tools of your craft can double as armaments. Is there anything you humans don't use to kill one another?"
"Probably not," I admitted.
"How peculiar."
He paused to look around at the ceiling. Disquieted by what he might choose to comment on next, I cleared my throat and curtsied. With a slight frown, he turned around and bowed back. "Ordinarily, I take clients in the parlor, which is this way. Should we get started? I wouldn't like to take too much of your time."
"Yes, certainly,"
he replied, But as we walked through the hall, he continued glancing upward and soon halted altogether to place his hand against the white plaster wall. I stopped too and waited for him to finish with a tight smile on my face, which was really more of a means of keeping myself from screaming in exasperation.
"There's a very strong enchantment on this house, and an odd one at that," he remarked finally.
"Yes." I started walking again, relieved to hear the swish of his coat follow. "It was the first thing I worked toward when I began painting these portraits. It took me an entire year to earn. No, fair one.
May harm an inhabitant within this house's walls so long as you live,"
he finished at a murmur.
"Impressive work. Gadflies."
I nodded, resisting the urge to look over my shoulder. As the parlor's distinct smell rolled over me, I adopted a more formal tone out of habit. "I've enjoyed his patronage for years. May I ask why you think it's odd?"
"I've never seen an enchantment like it before, nor would I have expected something like this of Gadfly."
Now it was my turn to almost come to a dead halt. I kept myself moving with a physical effort, entered the parlor, and went about mechanically arranging the charcoal I'd need for the day's sketch. Had the enchantment gone bad? Had I said something wrong to Gadfly all those years ago, left an accidental loophole in the terms of our arrangement? The possibility was so sickening, my hands and feet started going numb.
"As a prince, I could destroy most enchantments if I wished,"
he went on, still looking around at something I couldn't see.
"But when I said this one was strong, I meant it. It's far beyond even my power. Gadfly must have spent a great deal of energy to achieve such a working, which is out of the ordinary, since I've never seen him so much as get up out of a chair unless he had to. He must enjoy your craft immensely. I'm beginning to understand why he was so persistent in recommending I have a portrait done."
I blew out a steadying breath. One thing the prince had said sounded off. Gadfly had given me the impression he'd had nothing to do with this appointment, but I was so relieved the thought fled my mind almost instantly. "I had no idea," I said. "You're the first to tell me. No one else has ever mentioned it." The prince brushed past, his sleeve caressing my arm. The parlor appeared to interest him greatly. It was the largest room in my house and the most cluttered, though we took pains to keep it neat. At present, the only unoccupied piece of furniture was the settee beside the window. In the corner to my left, there was a varnished side table on which sat a crystal vase containing two peacock feathers, a set of imported china, a stack of leather-bound books, and an empty birdcage. The brocade chairs next to it were piled high with mismatched drapes, rugs, and curtains in every color and pattern imaginable. The rest of the room went on similarly, in each nook and cranny a different collection of curiosities, as though the parlor were a miniature, eclectic museum of human craft. My chair and easel sat unassumingly in the very center. The prince seemed too distracted to reply, so I continued. "When working with human patrons, portrait artists usually travel to their homes and paint them there. Because I can't do that with fair folk, of course, we choose furniture and decorations and arrange them to your liking here in this room."
"It restricts us,"
the prince murmured, touching his fingertips gently to the birdcage. He ran them down the thin metal bars. I remembered the raven sitting outside and wished I'd had the presence of mind to put the cage in another room, even as I wondered what on earth he was talking about. Never once had a fair one acted anything but pleased to surround themselves with the parlor's gaudy props. He snatched his fingers away and turned around. His pensiveness vanished into a smile like morning mist dissolved by the sun.
"Gadfly's enchantment, that is. Why none of us have mentioned it to you before. It feels like having a pair of shackles around our wrists, as light as spider silk, but strong as iron. No fair one enjoys commenting on their own weakness."
"But you're an exception, sir?"
"Oh, not at all. I don't enjoy it either."
His smile deepened, and the crooked dimple reappeared on his cheek.
"I just have little regard for discretion, as you might have noticed."
Indeed, I had. He was unlike any other fair one I'd ever met. "Is there a proper way to address you as prince?" I deferred, crossing the room to start sorting through the fabrics for a backdrop that would complement his wardrobe.
We don't observe such formalities,
he said, and glanced at me.
I would have thought you already knew that.
How, I wondered. It wasn't as though I had fairy royalty over for dinner.
In any case, my name is Rook.
I couldn't help but smile. That's fitting, sir. His eyes moved, searching my face, and it seemed to me his own smile grew even more familiar, confidential in a way I hadn't known a fair one could manage. Standing next to him, I became aware that the top of my head only reached to his chest. My cheeks warmed. Good Lord, I had a job to do. I think this brocade would suit you, I said, lifting a heavy, rust-colored silk with copper embroidery. He paused to look at it, almost impatiently. I always found this part interesting. One could learn precious little about fair folk, but occasionally their aesthetic choices opened windows into their souls. If they had them, that is, always a controversial matter at church. Gadfly enjoyed stuffing his frames full of as many expensive-looking trifles as possible. Another patron, Swallowtail, preferred only functional objects that had been used before, half-burnt candles, books with cracked spines and feathered corners. Rook shook his head at the brocade and bent to inspect a row of blown glass vases. He examined statuettes and mirrors, baskets full of wax fruit, chemistry bottles, quill pens, strangely arresting in his silence and grave concentration. I couldn't begin to imagine what he was thinking. Finally, he came back to the birdcage and looked up to find me watching him. His mercurial smile returned.
I've decided I don't want anything in my portrait, he declared, and went over to the settee.
He sat down with one arm stretched across the back and a knowing regard that told me he'd figured out exactly why I'd been watching him.
If you must stare at something for hours on end, I'd prefer it to be me alone.
I struggled to keep my expression serious. How gracious of you, sir. It will take me far less time to finish your portrait with you as the sole subject. He sat a little straighter and frowned, a trace of petulance darkening his aristocratic features. What was I doing? It was easy, so easy, for a fair one's pique to turn to dangerous ire. This wasn't like me. So many years of being cautious, and in a matter of minutes, I'd started slipping up. Swallowing my words, I went over to my chair, arranged my skirts, and selected a stick of charcoal. I pushed every other thought aside. It's difficult to explain what happens when I pick up a charcoal stick or a paintbrush. I can tell you the world changes. I see things one way when I'm not working, and an entirely different way when I am. Faces become not faces, structures composed of light and shadow, shapes and angles and texture. The deep luminous glow of an iris where the light hits it from the window becomes exquisitely compelling. I hunger for the shadow that falls diagonally across my subject's collar, the fine, lighter filaments in his hair ablaze like thread of gold. My mind and hand become possessed. I paint not because I want to, not because I'm good at it, but because it is what I must do, what I live and breathe, what I was made for. My concerns fell away along with the scrape of charcoal across paper. I didn't notice the soft black flakes sifting down, dusting my lap. First a circle, loose, energetic, capturing the shape of Rook's face. Then vigorous, wider lines sketching in the ensnaring tousle of his hair, his crown. No. I tore the paper off my easel, let it fall to the ground, and started in on a new one. Face, hair, crown. Eyebrows, dark and arching, a crooked half-smile. The blocky frame of his shoulders, good, better. There were two Rooks in the room now, both watching me. Neither was more real than the other. Beyond my easel, the living Rook tilted his head. He shifted where he sat. I felt him observing me and didn't care, lost in the fever of my craft. But with the small portion of my mind reserved for other thoughts, I noted he was getting restless and remembered what Gadfly had said to me the day before. Something about Rook having trouble sitting still.
Wait,
he said, and my charcoal scraped to a halt. I looked at him, my eyes adjusting back to the living world as though I'd just stared too hard at an optical illusion. Something about him seemed troubled. Briefly, I worried he was about to cancel his session.
Is it?
He frowned, grasping for words.
Fixed. The portrait. Can you make a change to it?
I let go of the breath I'd been holding. So that was all.